The Science Inside Podcast.
This is The Science Inside with Elmer.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is indeed Elmer Schutz. And for the next hour, I am joined by my team behind the scenes, as always, Bridget LePere on production and Kutlwana Same on tech. It's so good to be with you tonight. And I've got to say, even though I don't want to have favorites, this topic on today's show, or at least for the main story, is very close to my personal heart. And I think close to many of us. Today, being the 2nd of July, is the start of Mental Health Awareness Month here in South Africa and various other places around the world. And as you know, that term, mental health, is so big. It spans a large variety of issues, from mental illness and psychiatric disorders to broader mental disorders like substance abuse. And if I made a list of all the people in my life who struggle with depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar disorder, self-harm, suicidal thoughts, and so much more, it would be a very long list. And I'm sure you could make one of your own. And that list should concern all of us. Those people on that list should concern all of us, regardless of how distant or close the reality of these medical, psychological, emotional, and psychiatric issues are to us. The research in this field in South Africa is sadly limited. It surprised me. And yes, of course, it is quite a difficult thing to pin down into numbers in general, but still, I was a little bit surprised. There's one particular study called the South African Stress and Health Study, which took place in 2003 and 2004, which is, of course, quite a while back. And, of course, the numbers would have changed quite drastically since then. But it seems to be one of the most reliable sources of statistics for this. And it formed part of a more global research study and is, as I said, one of the only, if not the only one, in terms of large representative studies in this field in South Africa. And this study looked over a one-year-long span. It studied over 4,000 people and looked at some common mental disorders. Of course, not everything. That would just be too broad for one particular piece of research. And the results found that 16.5% of local adults had some disorder on the list. So that's one in six. That number goes up to almost one in three people if you're looking over a lifetime. These were especially major depressive disorder, agoraphobia without panic, which is when you are scared to leave safe zones like your house, and alcohol abuse, which they did classify as a disorder. And again, these are things that a lot of us are familiar with. But it's not just an issue. So I am very happy that we are making time on the show today to really stop and take this seriously, not just as medicine and science, even though we are looking at it from that lens also, but as something that is close to us. So in our main interview today, we speak to a psychologist about how we relate to mental health and how this affects our relationships. This is one both for those suffering of something or surviving something and those around them trying to support and connect. Then that's not the only thing we have on the show. As you know, we love having a mixed bag of things on the Science Inside. In our Unscience, where we look at funny and silly and strange research. Today, it's all about how science uses brain signals to figure out if someone is lying or not. And then later in the show, we look at a strange story around worms in teeth. If you've seen that online, you definitely want to find out whether that is science or fiction. That's all on the show. But before all of that, as always, we like to get into the news and look at some things that are happening in the world of science news. But just a big thank you to Africa Check and SADAG, the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, for some of those numbers I mentioned earlier, which are difficult to pin down, as I said. But for you, I would love, love to hear your stories, especially today, celebrating or rather commemorating Mental Health Awareness Month here. tell us what you have experienced, whether it is within yourself or with people in your life, and ask us questions. We have experts that would love to tell you more. So what you can do is find us as VowFM or on Twitter as well as Facebook, VowFM, hashtag Science Inside, really simple. And if you miss anything on today's show, it'll all be up on the podcast. Don't worry, it's on iTunes as the Science Inside, as well as our website is pretty easy to remember. It's vits.journalism.co.za/science. If all of that is too complicated for you, of course, there's the WhatsApp line that you should have saved by now, 0840784912. You can find all of that information online. But let's get into the show with the news up next.
This week's Science Headline.
As always, we are joined by Bridget LePere, our producer in studio, just to chat through some of the things that are happening in the world of science. And you have some slightly shocking statistics for us today, Bridget.
I sure do. How are you, Elna?
I'm really good. Let's get into it.
Yes. It is said in this study that air pollution is responsible for over 3 million new diabetes cases in a year. So this year would be 2016.
Okay. I thought the main cause for lifestyle diabetes was lifestyle. So chocolate, food, no?
No, not according to the study. They say small particle air pollution is linked to increased risk of many chronic diseases. More than 90% of air pollution-related deaths happen in Asia and Africa, but cities in the Americas, Europe, and Eastern Mediterranean, also have air pollution levels that are far beyond what the World Health Organization deems healthy. And in the study, which was presented by the Assistant Professor of Medicine, Dr. Ziad Al-Ali at Washington University, he says the risk of diabetes increased at air pollution levels which were well below Environmental Protection Agency's standards.
Okay, just clarify a little bit. You used a term there, small particle air pollution. I thought air pollution is air pollution.
Not according to this. Particulate air pollution is made up of microscopic pieces of dust, dirt, smoke, and soot mixed with liquid droplets. The finest particles regulated by the EPA are 2.5 micrometers. While in layman's terms, these particles are 30 times smaller than a strand of hair, which is 70 micrometers. The danger with these particles is that anything smaller than 10 micrometers does not only enter our lungs, but it also passes into the bloodstream.
Oh, wow.
And there it is carried to various organs and begins a chronic inflammatory reaction thought to lead to many of the chronic diseases such as asthma, lung cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and many others. And these particulates are largely created by manufacturing power plants, agriculture, and motor vehicle traffic.
Okay, you are mentioning some really big numbers. 3 million people is a lot, but over how much time is this? Is it in total? Is it over 1 year?
Well, as you would know, many of these studies are carried out overseas, but in the United States, air pollution was linked to 150 new cases of diabetes per year. So in 2016 alone, the study found that air pollution contributed to over 3.2 new diabetes cases around the world, and in total just over 4 million deaths were attributed to air pollution, according to the World Health Organization.
Okay, so how were they able to find these numbers? Sure, diabetes numbers I can understand, but diabetes specifically linked to air pollution?
Well, researchers gathered data on 1.7 million U.S. veterans with no history of diabetes who had been closely monitored for an average of 8.5 years or so. They controlled all the variables known to cause diabetes. They also ran a series of statistical models comparing the veterans' levels of diabetes to pollution levels documented by the EPA and NASA. So veterans who are exposed to air pollution between 5 to 10 micrograms per cubic meter of air, which is less than the EPA's prescribed 12 milligrams safety level. So they also found that 21% of them had developed diabetes. The study also shows that being exposed to higher levels of between 11.9 to 13.6 micrograms created a greater risk, indicating that 24% of them had developed diabetes. So researchers indicated that though an increase of 3% may seem insignificant, it translates to an additional 5,000 to 6,000 new diabetes cases per 100,000 people annually.
Wow, and it's quite shocking that there's such a big effect despite these levels being below the recommended amount. So maybe they should be looking at their regulations a little bit closer also, just to take this into account more. But something I'm sure all of us want to know is which cities are affected by this especially.
The study has pointed out that it is difficult to rank cities because the data was collected from various sources. But according to WHO, cities with higher pollution numbers included Los Angeles, Bakersfield, California, Indiana, Kentucky, and many others. And the Lancet Commission on Pollution and Health released a report that over 90% of pollution-related deaths occurred in low- and middle-income countries. And among those hardest hit were the minorities, the poor, with children being the most vulnerable group, even with exposures to low doses, dose of air pollution. So air pollution was responsible for 9 million premature deaths worldwide in 2015. This is 15 times more deaths than all wars, violence combined, and 3 times more than malaria, TB, and AIDS combined.
Okay, that's shocking, to say the least, but if the first world countries are more polluted, what causes third world countries or other countries to face the same challenges?
Well, poorer countries have fewer resources and they also tend to be very relaxed when it comes to clean air policies. These were countries such as China, India and its neighbors, Pakistan and Bangladesh. They faced a higher diabetes pollution risk, while healthier countries such as France, Finland, and Iceland faced a low risk because of the very strict clean air policies and regulations. And African nations of Nigeria, the DRC, Ethiopia, and Tanzania are among those countries bearing the heaviest burden of air pollution.
Sure, it just shows you how these things are so interconnected, even with diabetes and our personal health. Air pollution isn't just something that ruins your sunrise or your sunset. It can, it should be regulated where it can be.
True. And this information from this report was sourced from Health Effects Institute and the State of Global Air 2018 report and CNN.
Great. So my story for you, Bridget, just to continue our news, is from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, via Science Daily. And even in Joburg, it gets a little bit rainy. So, Bridget, do you have that good waterproof coat?
You mean like a raincoat?
Yeah.
I do own one.
So you're safe when it rains.
Plus, I use an umbrella.
So you're really protected from all the rain. And I think most of us, you know, we know that especially when we're out hiking, commuting, you don't really have a choice. It's not like you can always just hide under a building or something. You can often get wet, and it seems like the kind of thing that's sorted, right? We have raincoats.
Yeah,
it's fine. Why are you even talking about this? Well, turns out that even though these waterproof or water repellent fabrics that we all know and probably have in our cupboard actually are not as good for us as we think they are. First of all, most of them do eventually let through water instead of making these droplets bounce off, as would be the ideal. But there's another problem I had honestly never heard about, Bridget. Apparently, the fabric coatings that normally get used have been shown to accumulate in the environment and in body tissue, and in some cases be bad for your health. So your raincoat is affecting you, possibly. And we're talking clothing, footwear, even backpacks, sleeping bags, and tents. And it's gotten to the point that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has changed their rules, or started to change their rules, trying to phase these out, even though it's been the norm for ages.
Wow, I hope you're not going to tell me that there's some bacteria that's been collecting for decades in the raincoat. But I never actually thought that this would be a problem. So what should we use instead?
So it is all about this coating. Thankfully, it isn't a bacteria. It has to do with how this coating is structured. And that's exactly the question the researchers have been trying to answer. If not this, then what? And the team at MIT seems to have found the best answer, at least one of the best so far. So their new coating can go on natural fabrics like silk, cotton, all kinds of things. It's better at repelling water droplets than the other coatings, which is already really pretty good. But very importantly, it doesn't have those side effects, so it's less likely to be toxic to humans.
Awesome. So how does it work?
You need to just understand, firstly, the old stuff, or the stuff that gets used, has a chemical structure of long chain polymers with very certain side chains. And they're based in a liquid. So once the fabric that you want to coat is dipped in that and dried out, it then needs to be blown through with air to open up the pores and let the fabric breathe. So all of that is a bit pricey. It breaks down how water resistant the fabric is. And so technically you'd want a shorter chain polymer, but those aren't working up till now. So what this particular team at MIT did was develop a shorter chain polymer that they would then combine with a different new way of coating. It's called initiated chemical vapor deposition, ICVD, and has only been around for a few years, so no wonder that it is new. And they hopped onto this ICVD coating, and together it creates a thin uniform coat over the fabric without the liquid steps or even the extra processes. So it doesn't have that side effect of the long polymer chains, but it has even stronger water repellency.
Cool. Who knew that so much research goes into raincoats, right?
Yeah, and here's the cool thing. It even works on something like paper.
Wow. That would open up some interesting new options.
Yeah, especially if they can do paper. What about, I don't know, there's all kinds of things. I'd be really interested to see how this can develop further. And they are hoping to patent and get this out pretty soon. So it's a good solution for all of us, and we can stop worrying about raincoats. If I just made you worry, it's okay. I've given you the solution right along with it. I hope you're caught up now on what's happening in the science news in the world. Just a couple of quick stories before we get into our main one for today. It is about Mental Health Awareness Month.
This is The Science Inside with Elmer.
Welcome to the show. If you've just tuned in, remember you can find us on social media. Get in on this conversation at VowFM on Facebook and Twitter using the hashtag ScienceInside. The other very important hashtag, which brings us to our topic for today, is hashtag Mental Health Awareness Month. That is exactly what's being celebrated or commemorated this July. And as I said earlier, mental health covers a lot of different things. We are aware of that, from severe psychiatric illnesses to just how each one of us handles our psychological and emotional state on the day-to-day. There are so many conversations to be had around specific issues like depression, anxiety, eating disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder. But since it's an awareness month, I want us to think about this a little bit differently and have a conversation around how these medical and psychological and psychiatric conditions exist not in a scientific vacuum, but in our society and our relationships, our friendships, our families. To put it simply, How do we deal with this? Whether it's the mental health of ourselves or those around us. So to help us with this, I have on the line Leanne Lurie. She's a clinical psychologist in private practice and an associate with the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, SADAG, who is doing a lot around Mental Health Awareness Month. Leanne, thank you so much for joining us for this very important conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we all have feelings. We all have thoughts and emotions. They can regularly be in turmoil and transition. None of us are gray blobs with perfect balance. So sometimes it can be hard to know whether something is normal or actually really a problem that we should ask others for help for. So how can we tell? Yeah, whether that's in ourselves or in other people, whether something should be taken more seriously than a hug and some chocolate ice cream.
So look, I mean, obviously normal is a very like relative term, and what's normal for you and me versus what's normal for somebody else may be something completely different. And obviously how we define normal, you know, is also often based on, you know, on our backgrounds, on our cultures, on, you know, on how we've been raised. Essentially, like what we say is that we all know sort of what our baseline level of functioning is. So we know, you know, the things that need to get us going every day. You know, can we get up? Are we able to, you know, eat and sleep properly? Are we able to take care of our day-to-day kind of our hygiene, of our functioning? Are we, you know, able to see commitments through on a social, occupational, interpersonal, you know, level? Or has there been either sort of a gradual or a very sort of fast kind of decline in our functioning? Have people started to comment on massive changes, you know, in our behavior, in our appearance, for example, in like things that we call sort of your activities of daily living? Now, look, depending on the severity of what you're dealing with. So are you dealing with somebody who's presenting, for example, let's say with just kind of a basic kind of low mood, or has it declined into a major depressive disorder, or are you dealing with somebody, for example, who maybe displaying signs of psychosis, who are either hearing voices or seeing things that aren't necessarily there, you know, their reality testing has become like poor. And then, you know, we look at, you know, how is it impacting on themselves? And also, most importantly, does the person present as a risk to themselves, or are they also a risk to others? And I think also, I think that very often for an individual, they may realize that they're not functioning at their optimum, or somebody else is not functioning at their optimum. But whilst you may have the insight into it, doing something about it is that much harder. And sometimes also, like, the person may be filled with a sense of shame in terms of actually being able to reach out for help, or in terms of that they're scared they're going to be stigmatized, or, you know, what does this actually say about me? So what we say to somebody, okay, for example, if you're worried about yourself, okay, you know, is there somebody within your support system that you can speak to? Do you need to go for professional help? Does that mean starting off, for example, let's say, seeing a social worker, a psychologist, a counselor, or just, you know, simply going to have a chat, you know, with your doctor about what some of your symptoms have been? Or do you need, you know, for example, to go and seek the services of a psychiatrist? Okay. In terms of reaching out to somebody else, again, you have to look at the severity of what you're dealing with. And very often, if you point out to somebody that you don't think they're coping and that they need help, you may be met with a lot of defensiveness. And so you can leave a space open to say, you know, I can see you're not coping. I can see something's up. You know, I'm here if you need me. I'm here to help you get support. Okay, that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, for example, let's say we're dealing with somebody who's having some kind of psychotic breakdown. They may not obviously have the insight to recognize what's going on with them. And in those instances, we have to look at whether we need to intervene in such a way that the person gets help, even if it's on an involuntary basis.
That does make a lot of sense. But the thing is, to carry on from that, even if we get somebody into into whatever kind of help they need, it has to carry on from there. It's not just a couple of sessions and a couple of pills to pop. And
no, of course not.
The support system around that person is a real interest to me, because what does that look like practically? It's easy to say, I have compassion for somebody with mental health challenges or some kind of mental illness. But on the long term, I think it can get very, very tough for that person to keep reaching out continually to the support network, and the support network to continue being there, or the ecosystem to continue being there. And just to give some harsh examples, in a sense, it can seem sometimes like if you have a friend with social anxiety, even though you want to have empathy, you might get... You know, you might get sick of the fact that they never want to see you or have fun, or, the highs and lows of bipolar disorder could really strain constant relationships. How does one handle, how does that practical support system look like?
So look, I think on the first level, I think the individual has to educate themselves and empower themselves on the nature of the condition that they are dealing with. Because once they have that information in their hands, they can also position themselves better with whatever support system they have in terms of actually like explaining the symptoms, explaining some of the behaviors that other people may see. And to also, you know, to say to your support system, if you see me doing, let's say, X, Y, and Z, let's talk about somebody, for example, who's got a bipolar mood disorder, okay, and who may manifest, let's say, like manic symptoms. So they can say, right, if you see that I'm not sleeping, that my like thoughts are running away, that my speech is pressured, for example, you know, that I'm feeling invincible, please understand this is not something that's in my control. It's not something I'm doing on purpose. These are my warning signs, and at that point, I'm giving you permission, you know, to get me help. Okay. Yes, you raise a very important point that I think that, you know, people that have not been through, you know, some kind of like psychological, psychiatric distress, or maybe people that have just, you know, themselves have compassion fatigue and burnout from caring for, you know, people that have not been well, they're not always going to be empathic. They may also, you know, also present almost as quite insensitive to the individual. And so what we also say is that you also have to learn to build community and build support outside of your family, for example, or outside of your friends. Because as much as a family or friends, like those systems, may try and have the best intentions in the world, sometimes they don't get it right. And of course, there's no recipe and there's no one-size-fits-all. Mm. So, you know, for example, like, look at a resource like the South African Depression and Anxiety Support Group. Find out what support groups are available in your area. You know, like, go to those meetings. Empower yourself, like, in that regard. Surround yourself with other people that also have direct experience in terms of the condition that you're dealing with. You know, also, if you're going to go and see some kind of mental health practitioner, if you have a social worker, a psychologist, your GP, a nurse, a psychiatrist, take people that are important to you with you. Mm-hmm. You know, empower them. Don't make this whole division of sort of them and us in terms of, you know, in terms of, well, nobody understands me and I'm on my own, you know, in this journey. Allow people to ask questions. That's the one thing. The other thing as well is that we also say to people that, yes, you're not responsible for the diagnosis that you have. You didn't choose to have this mental illness, but you are responsible for doing what you can in terms of keeping yourself well. And if that means, for example, keeping your own symptom diary in terms of, let's say, your sleeping patterns, your eating patterns, what's happening with your thoughts, how are you managing your stress levels, are you regularly following up, you know, with your primary healthcare practitioner? If you're on medication, are you taking it properly? Because at the same time, I think what very often happens is that families or support systems also develop compassion fatigue when, for example, they see that you're not taking care of yourself properly and those things are in your control. And that's when there's a sort of a level of anger is generated towards the sufferer because the person at that point throws their hands up and because they feel helpless, because they don't know what to do for you anymore, and they then withdraw.
Yeah. Leanne, what should happen in a case where the ecosystem or the support system, the general system around that person and the conditions of living aren't what they should be? There isn't enough people to take care of them, or the influence of poverty or other people suffering of other illnesses around them. We've got to see, as you have been describing, we've got to see mental illness not in a vacuum, not just as a diagnosis on a piece of paper. What do we do, or what should happen when the ideal care is not adequately there?
Yeah, and I think it's an exceptionally relevant question. I think especially in the South African context, you know, in which we find ourselves, especially in the wake of the last Isidomeni travesty and tragedy. You know, these are questions that we have to be asking. And I think that we know that we have a severe shortage. You know, for example, let's say of halfway house facilities, you know, that can also cater to individuals where the family cannot provide, you know, the infrastructure and the emotional, for example, and even the financial support for the individual. You know, in an ideal situation, you know, you'd hope that there are social workers in your community that can get involved, that, you know, can do regular checkups, you know, like on the individual, that there are community-based kind of support groups available. But we also know very sadly that it doesn't happen. We also know that there are vast, you know, cultural differences in terms of how one would understand, you know, a presentation of mental illness. And of course there's no one size, you know, fits all. That, you know, you may have patients, for example, that present to, let's say, within like a Western sort of medical framework, and, you know, a doctor may diagnose them with depression. But obviously within their community, the framework may be viewed very differently, and the individual may be viewed as having been bewitched. So the psychiatrist will say, okay, you've got to take X, Y, and Z medication. And the community will say, no, you actually need to go and see, you know, one of the, let's say, for example, one of the Sangomas, and, you know, you need to rely on traditional remedies. And it doesn't mean that a Western framework is right and that a traditional framework is wrong. It doesn't mean that at all. But I think that there also needs to be a greater sort of meeting of minds, so that both the Western and a traditional framework can also understand where the other is coming from, and so that interventions can, in an ideal world, can be tailored towards the needs of the individual, so that there is understanding and there is additional support.
And this brings me to that point where so many discussions around mental health and mental illness land, which is that this isn't just a scientific medical issue, but it's also not the stereotypes and the stigmas that are very prevalent in South Africa around pull yourself together.
Yeah, pull up your socks.
Yes. So lastly, Leanne, what can you leave us with in terms of the best way of placing mental health in our relationships, in our community? What is the best way that you would recommend we see it?
So look, I think that if you are worried about yourself or you're worried about somebody else, don't be afraid to have those courageous conversations. Don't be afraid to actually point it out. And I think, you know, very often all of us, we're very scared of what we don't know. We're scared of something that presents as out of the ordinary. And rather than sort of rushing to judgment or, for example, isolating or shunning that individual, have the courage and the heart to, you know, to express that you're worried about them in a very, like, non-judgmental fashion. And you know, either seek help for the individual, or if you are the individual that's struggling, seek help. Because I think very often what happens for, like, all of us is that, you know, we cope, and there's such a pressure to cope, and then the wheels fall off the wagon, and one day you actually you can't get out of bed and you can't function. Mm-hmm. And rather seek help and nip something in the bud before it actually becomes this massive, massive issue. The other thing as well, I think that is so important to realize that, you know, often you think that you're completely alone and you're struggling in your own head. Only to find when you start to talk to someone, let's say even as part of a support group, or you phone a telephone counselor, you start to learn that there are actually many more people around you who also similarly struggling, but they won't open up. And by you opening, you give them permission to open up.
Mm. Strong, good advice from Leanne Lurie, that we should take mental health very seriously, not just this Mental Health Awareness Month, but always, whether it is in ourselves or our loved ones. Leanne, thank you so much for speaking.
Thank you very much for having me.
And she is an associate of the South African Depression and Anxiety Group that I've got to say has some really great information out there on their website, sadag.org. You can find all kinds of things. If you think that you're maybe not coping, they also have support groups. But something that I especially like, especially for people who are busy, for students, for people who think, oh, Alma, you've said great things, but I don't think I can walk into a counselor's office. I don't think I can do that for whatever reason. What I love is that they have these cool mental health lines, helplines, where you can sit in a corner in your room in the quiet, call someone. Nobody has to know that you're reaching out, and somebody can really help you. So I'm going to give you some of those numbers. You can also find them online. The mental health line at SADAG is 011-234-4837. But the one I really want you to remember, the 24-hour helpline, is 0800-121314. 0800-121314. Go and save it into your phone right now. You never know when you're just going to need a chat or when you're in serious trouble. Here on The Science Inside, we really do love talking about mental health and making it a wider conversation, not just around the medical aspect, but the very real social and emotional aspect around it. Do keep listening, because after the break, it is Unscience.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on The Science Inside. You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
By now, you probably know how it goes on the show. In the middle of everything, we take a little bit of a break. It's still science, but it gets a little bit strange or funny, because there are funny sides to science, and I do really enjoy talking about them, but it can also get very relevant to our lives. It's called Unscience. We look at the weird and wonderful side of what scientists spend a lot of time and effort and even money on. Today's Unscience was produced by Bridget LePere and comes from Science Daily and Slate. Let's get into it.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
Bridget LePere is with us back in studio, our producer. What have you got for us?
Well, today we are going to be talking about, you guessed it, imagine a world where deception is a thing of the past, where we could use science to solve mysteries and figure out whether a person is lying or not.
Okay, that would be terrific, of course, for a lot of people, at least not people who lie very often, if I had that kind of tick. But we do have that tick. Bridget, don't you remember we actually covered polygraphs a little while ago?
I do remember. I am very much aware of that. But what I'm talking about right now ventures into neurosciences, where science uses a person's brain signals to figure out if someone is lying or not. And this brings me to a study that is looking at neurolaw. And they are looking at the ethical implications and what in the case where a person is unwilling to testify or to give evidence. So if their brain is actually admitting to guilt.
Okay. Explain to us more how this works and how it's different to polygraphs.
Well, unlike polygraphs, which use different parts of the body, such as looking at things like twitching and accelerated heart rate and all those other intricate details, brain science through the use of fMRI monitors and tracks flashings of light in different parts of the brain depending on whether the person is lying or not. A review published in Frontiers in Neuroscience explores the current literature and advancements in the applications of neuroscience law, and the challenges with neuroscience is that the law is facing difficulties in drawing a fine line between what is justifiably ethical or not.
You know, you lie and you waste your time.
Ooh, okay. So what you're saying is that as much as a third party, let's say the police, with the use of neuroscience techniques that you were describing, may go overboard in their scanning, that the law is being employed to protect the brain rights of people being scanned?
Correct. Previous applications have been used to determine whether someone has intimate knowledge of a crime, and it is being viewed for its potential to be used in legal cases and inform judges and juries. So the researchers working on this study, Professor James Giordano from Georgetown University, says using this technology will definitely give great insights into that individual's capabilities. But he also adds that because the technology is available does not necessarily mean it's okay to use.
That's the thing with this. Just because it's available, just because it's, you know, possible to use this to solve crimes, I don't think it should necessarily be used. There's still human rights.
Right. And they are looking at building a framework of defined guidelines which will govern how neuroscientific methods are being used, whether they are used correctly and effectively within the constraints of the law.
Okay, I see the dilemma that they're facing. When you look at the one hand, you have great science, which can work really well if the person is really guilty. But then on the other hand, it would be open to abuse and transgressing human rights. And as was with the polygraph, that applies, or that door is open, even if people are not guilty and can cause harm.
Exactly. And this technology brings to the fore a violation of a person's right to privacy. It is sort of a crime against a person's dignity in a way, because it leaves the person vulnerable. And this is being considered whether it should be permitted in court. The researchers also looked at previous cases where neuroscientific techniques were used to determine truth and infer intent. In the United States, it was used for the first time in 2010, and current rules of federal evidence provide strict criteria which constrain how brain science can be used.
You can't handle the truth!
So what other things did this study find?
Professor Giordano and Calvin Kraft from University of Notre Dame both insist on the need for discussions around threats and an individual's rights to privacy, and to also try and iron out the vague definitions of what exactly is the private domain. Guidelines which take into consideration both the potential and limitations of brain science in its legal context. Mm. And this would translate to how far into one psyche would neurosciences be allowed to go. And before being guilty of trespassing a person's brain space, so to speak, this review will also serve as a starting point for exploring the relationship between brain science, ethics, and law on a global scale.
This is so tricky because law obviously tries to find guilty and innocent. Did you do it or didn't you do it?
Yeah.
And so if you have these kind of scientific methods that seem reliable, I can understand how some people would say, well, if Bridget is guilty, I get to look into her brain. But of course, as you mentioned, human rights and also just the gray area here, that these things aren't always as simple, makes it a lot more difficult.
Yeah, not everything is black and white, you know. Well, unusual, unlikely, unscience. And this information was gathered from thesciencedaily.com and slate.com.
Okay, so If you're interested in neuroscience, I think this was a very strange but good, very applicable research study to really see how does science come together with the law and how far is too far. What is if I get my hands on this and I want to use this not for a criminal case but to find out if my boyfriend is cheating? Is that still science? I'm not so sure. But stay with us on the Science Inside. We'll be back after the break.
Unusual. Unlikely. Unscience. This is the Science Inside with Elna.
Now in the show is the part where we ask some questions. And we hope that science will find us some answers. Sometimes it is pretty clear. It's a yes or a no. It's science or it's fiction. It's a myth or it's a myth bust. And a lot of the time, even science can't give you such simple answers for life, unfortunately. But that's what we love to do, and we always learn something. Today, the notion that worms are the cause behind toothaches has been something that has been passed on from one generation to the next in certain cultures. But do we still believe these tales even in the modern age of technology? While on a visit to the doctor, I recently overheard women talking about various remedies for toothaches. You might have heard stories like this before. And there's a use of an indigenous plant called Kouhut that you might have heard about. It's also called Psyllium tortosum, which is a succulent plant commonly found in South Africa in the Western Cape region. It is also known as Kana, Chana, as I said, Kouhut, which literally means chewable things or something to chew. And these ladies or these people that believe in this usually say that a traditional healer who uses herbs to extract worms from teeth, that is how these herbs get used. They extract worms from your teeth. And apparently, these traditional healers then burn indigenous herbs, place the ashes on a stick, and place the stick with these herbs into a person's mouth. And then apparently the smoke from the herb kills the worms that exist there and then they come out. So once the extracting of the worms is over, the person spits into a container and the traditional healer shows them the worms. So this is a story that's making the rounds. So as per usual, we thought let's take it in our stride. Let's find out if there is some science behind these practices. We spoke to a dentist who runs his practice in Springs, Dr. Yakshin Lindy.
No, most certainly not. There's no worms per se that exist in teeth. There are microbials that exist in the mouth. They're in the form of bacteria, and that can be present in the tooth. But they are such minute microscopic that they're not visible to the naked eye. So if the traditional healers are saying that they can see the worms actually coming out, then that is false. Although, mind you, I have seen a video whereby there have been maggots which have exuded from a specific wound in the buccal surface, which is the cheek side of a patient's mouth. But that was due to unforeseen circumstances of the patient having extremely bad hygiene. And obviously, there have been, you know, other facets of larvae that was laid into this wound site. But as for toothache per se, there's no such thing as worms in the tooth. There's bacteria that causes inflammation within the tooth, but definitely not worms in the tooth, no.
Modern technology through the invention of the microscope has made it possible to examine the tooth pulp very closely. And scientists have discovered that teeth contain hollow tubes located in the dentin of the teeth, according to the American Dental Association. So diseased teeth can give off a worm-like appearance. So just going on to further find out, is it possible that brake fluid can actually soothe toothaches?
It's definitely not advisable and it's definitely not healthy. In fact, it's contraindicatory because what brake fluid does, and not just brake fluid, I've heard this myth across many a tradition. Some people use brake fluid, some people use paraffin, some people use. Even clove oil in its essence, that does remove pain, and it does not remove, but reduce the pain. But essentially what it's doing is it's just masking the symptoms. And masking the symptom means reducing the pain, but not removing the cause. The cause is still there. So essentially what it's doing is, if you can imagine, you have a broken arm. If you don't cast that broken arm and put it into something that will immobilize it, you will still continue using that broken arm and it will cause more damage for the arm per se. But if you use something like paraffin or brake fluid and stuff, it's going to mask the symptom whereby it reduces the pain by blocking the tubules or by rendering the site parasthetic, which is a little bit of, you know, no feeling in there. But essentially, you're going to be biting, you're going to be chewing, you're going to be carrying on using the site, which will cause more damage. And that is the primary direct cause of damage. But the indirect cause of damage would be that the brake fluid contained chemicals, it contained acids, it contains all of these variables that can cause soft tissue damage. So essentially, it's going to be doing more harm than it is doing any positive, which is to remove the pain. Because remember, pain is just a symptom of a greater problem that exists. So while bodies are telling us there's something wrong, they're sorted out. That's why we have pain. So essentially, the cause must be removed and definitely not masked by brake fluid or anything else.
Modern dentistry has proven that most toothaches are caused by dental problems resulting from tooth decay, plaque, and tartar. Plaque develops when bacteria builds up on the surface of the teeth and irritates the gum tissue and accumulates on the enamel. And this causes cavities that may expose the sensitive tooth pulp. Gum disease, as you may know from your dentist, is also a leading cause of dental disease. So poor oral hygiene is the primary cause of gum disease. In particular, in the following, Dr. Lindy gives advice on what a healthy oral health routine and plan looks like.
As with our country, and you know, we've got a lot of pre-existing conditions and a lot of systemic problems, the best thing that one can do to assist toothache and pain is prevention. So that's from a young age. People should be regularly going for the dentist for checkup and for cleanings and polishings and for fillings and all of the minor things, so that it doesn't get to a stage whereby there's decay and then there's pain and there's subsequent removal and then there's replacement. You know, because as you go higher onto these levels of treatment plans, things also get much more expensive. And that is why they say healthcare isn't expensive. It's neglect that is the expense. So there needs to be prevention. If pain exists for unforeseeable circumstances such as trauma or anything else on that spectrum, then patients should also seek professional advice. Professional advice is the only way that there can be relief of pain and removal of the cause, as I said. So there needs to be a twofold approach. Number one, prevention, and number two, seeking professional advice. Because home care remedies, yes, they find they can take away pain on a transient level, but on a broad spectrum, there needs to be a removal of the cause. So essentially, what people need to do is the right thing, which is prevention and then seeking professional help. And it doesn't need to be expensive professional advice, help, such as going to a specialist or going to a primary healthcare facility. You can go to your general clinic and they'll be able to not per se diagnose anything that's too specific. It's within the scope of practice and the field of spectrum, but they'll be able to then refer to an appropriate clinic in the government facility as well, because I've worked there, and they will be able to take those necessary steps to bring about pain relief.
So if you've heard any myths around teeth, like the ability to extract worms that are causing harm to your teeth, today on our section around strange science ideas floating around, at least it was pretty clear. Modern medicine, or modern dentistry at least, says no. There's no question about it. There are probably not worms in your teeth. It just looks like it. So one win for science on that one. We're going to finish off the show in just a minute. Stay with us.
This is The Science Inside with Elna.
It's been such a good show today, from that very enlightening and serious conversation about how we talk about mental health and to people in our lives with mental illnesses, to unscience around whether brain scanning should be used in the law. And then lastly, are there worms in our teeth? No. Very simple answer there today. It's been a good show, and a big thank you goes to all of our guests featured on the show today, including Leanne Lurie and Dr. Yakshin Lindy. Our team behind the scenes works so hard on the show. Production by Bridget LePere and tech by Kutlwano Saame. If you missed anything, it's not a problem, because the podcast is on iTunes as The Science Inside and vits.journalism.co.za/science. Very simple website. Also, you can find us on Facebook as VowFM, also on Twitter. My name is Elna Schutz. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology, as always. I'll be back with you next week.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on VowFM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.